This is Stateside. I'm Max Johnston. Maybe it's the warm weather and the first signs of spring, or maybe it's just that we've been living with COVID-19 for over a year now, and we're tired of it. But as more and more Michiganders are eligible for vaccines, it seems like the light at the end of the tunnel has got some of us feeling restless and ready for this pandemic to be over. But history tells us it isn't quite that simple. One medical historian at the University of Michigan says, as we consider post-pandemic life, there's a lot we can learn from how Americans handled the end of the 1918 influenza pandemic. J. Alexander Navarro is assistant director of the Center for the History of Medicine, and he's here with us now. Alex, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So start off, just set the scene for us a little bit. What kind of public health measures were in place in the influenza pandemic, and how were Americans feeling about them as cases started going down at the time?
Yeah, so the slate of measures that were used were very similar to the ones used today. We call them non-pharmaceutical interventions. So that means the social distancing measures that were used today, the mask recommendations, sometimes mandates in certain communities, isolation and quarantine, all of those types of things. And they implemented those, most communities did, school closures as well, implemented those measures in the early days or weeks of the pandemic. Now, when it came to business closures, they weren't quite as sweeping as the ones that we used, say, in the spring, last spring, during COVID-19. They were more relegated to places of public amusement, so movie theaters, performance theaters, bowling alleys, those types of places. And that's because, in large part, the economy was so different then. It was dominated by the manufacturing sector. No one was going to talk about closing factories, of course. And this was wartime, and so a lot of those factories were involved in providing war munitions. But other than that, they were fairly similar to the types of things that we've been using today to try and combat COVID-19, and at least slow the spread. At the end of the pandemic, now the pandemic in 1918, it's different for many different reasons, not least of which is it was a different virus. The pandemic, the worst of the pandemic in 1918 was in the fall of 1918, and it was over in about 4 to maybe 6 weeks, the worst of it. It continued on through the winter of 1919, however. Several weeks into these closure orders, people started to get a little restless. You know, movie theater owners were a little upset that they were losing out on box office receipts. Saloon owners were angry. Clergy were angry that churches were closed, especially in places where saloons weren't closed. And so there's a push in many communities to reopen. And when the worst appears to be over, in fact, health officers come out and say that pandemic is over, expect disease to continue and deaths to continue, but we can go back to reopening. And when they open those doors, everyone, I mean, every city we studied, they just flock to downtown districts to go to movies, to go shopping, etc. And in many communities, the pandemic was not over, and there was a resurgence of cases. In some cities, that second resurgence in the fall was actually worse than the first spike.
Wow. I mean, the parallels are just, I mean, ongoing. 100 years ago, what were the signs that the influenza pandemic might be ending? How did people at the time sort of sense things were maybe getting better? And how were people's perceptions of public safety precautions sort of coming up?
Yeah. So at the beginning of the pandemic, influenza was not a reportable disease anywhere. So physicians were not regularly reporting cases of influenza. And so the first thing that public health officers did at the state and local level was to mandate that physicians and hospitals report influenza cases. And they would have reported influenza as well as pneumonia cases, because they knew then, as we know now, that a large number of those cases would develop pneumonia, and some of those cases would end in death due to secondary bacterial infections. So that's how they were tracking the number of cases and the number of deaths. And they did keep daily tallies of the new numbers of cases and deaths. These were regularly reported to the public in the newspapers. And so they knew when they reached the peak, and then, you know, say a week later, you see that number decreasing. Maybe 2 weeks later, it's continuing to decrease. And so they knew that they were on the backside of that initial spike. They, unfortunately, I think in many places, they sort of jumped the gun, thinking that they were coming down on the other side of the pandemic. Really, what they were doing, we're very familiar with this term today, is they were flattening their curves. They just didn't realize it. They didn't have the same epidemiological knowledge then that we do today. And there was the feeling was that you really couldn't change too much the outcome of a pandemic. And in fact, this was something that we ran into in our own research as late as 2005, 6, and 7. We had public health officers and epidemiologists telling us that the social distancing measures just wouldn't work at all. In fact, we know now that that's not the case. They do work. And so public health officers at the time thought they did the best they could, that they maybe cut down on some of the cases and deaths, and that it was time to reopen. And of course, they were also getting pressure from their constituents, from business owners, et cetera.
And another parallel between the 1918 pandemic and this current one was the controversy over wearing masks. There was back and forth at the time over mask wearing during the flu pandemic. Tell me just, you know, looking back a little bit, how did public health leaders attempt to persuade people to wear masks back then, and how effective were they?
So nationwide, there were various sort of mask recommendation orders from different organizations, especially the American Red Cross. There was no real federal mask guidance, or really any federal guidance at all. That's just the way that even today that public health statutes are set up. They're all at the local and state level. And the Wilson administration was primarily preoccupied with prosecuting the war, and there was a bad disease outbreak epidemic in the military camps. And so the federal response was really relegated to the military. At the state and local level, there were a number of recommendations to wear masks, and especially out west, a number of mask mandates. Indianapolis was one city outside of the west that did have a mask mandate, but most of the communities that mandated their use were in the west, so Denver, Seattle, Sacramento, San Francisco, most famously or infamously. And it's very similar to today. That it was, you know, met with a lot of mixed reactions. Most people grumbled about it. Masks then, as well as now, are uncomfortable to wear, and people generally don't like wearing them. But there seemed to be a fairly high level of compliance. But at the same time, there were reports of hundreds and hundreds of people in each of these communities being fined and arrested and fined for not wearing their masks. And these fines were quite stiff. They were typically $5 or $10, but there were reports of fines of $100 or $200 being levied on some people, along with jail time. And still, that didn't seem to deter some people. In San Francisco, so many people were angry about wearing a mask that when the city issued a second mandatory mask order in January of 1919, that 2,000 citizens formed the Anti-Mask League, and they met in an auditorium, unmasked, of course, and they listened to speeches by local prominent physicians, some of them who claimed that masks were ineffective. There was a member of the County Board of Supervisors there. There were other people saying that masks, these mandates were an infringement on their civil liberties. All of the same types of things we're seeing today.
Sort of broadening out to the public health system in 1918 as a whole, I wanted you to sort of compare and contrast a bit with what we have now. When it comes to enforcing these public health orders, these restrictions and safety measures, what did that look like in 1918? And obviously, many things have changed since then. What does that sort of look like now?
Yeah, they were actually quite heavy-handed in 1918, generally speaking. You know, if you were a business owner and you were forced to close and you opened your business, you were fined. You were arrested and fined in most cases. We have lots of reports of saloon keepers defying the order in various states and communities and facing court cases. Certainly, I alluded to mask. You know, if you were flaunting the mask ordinance and you were arrested, you were typically fined. And sometimes faced jail as well, a short jail sentence. You know, the mayor of Oakland, California, where there was a mask mandate, traveled to Sacramento, which also had a mask mandate, was caught not wearing his mask and was arrested. Protested, he said, "I'm the mayor of Oakland." They didn't care. They threw him in the jail cell anyway until he could pay his $5 fine. He only had a $20 bill on him, and so he had to wait there for several hours until they arrested other people who would pay their fine so they could make change for him. So they took this quite seriously in many communities. Now, of course, there were other communities where we have evidence of officials not taking it very seriously. So Newark, New Jersey, for example, the mayor of Newark flaunts the state orders and allows saloons to essentially operate as business as usual. And he challenges the state law. And it turns out that in the end, he actually had the authority. It wasn't the state director of public health. One of the things that happened after the pandemic in many communities is they found that there were loopholes in their public health laws. The same here in Michigan, for example. Governor Sleeper issues a closure order, and no community really challenged it, but it turns out they found out after he didn't have the authority to do so, the legal authority. And so they had to change the law in 1919 to allow the Department of Health to do that. And that is the law that we're currently using now after the October court case last year, where the Supreme Court struck down the governor's emergency powers law and said you have to use this 1919 law to issue closure orders through the Department of Health.
And so once, going back to 1918, once these safety measures started to ease, was it a gradual return back to sort of in-person gathering? Did people rush back into it? What did that look like?
So from the evidence that we have, it seems like it was a big rush to get back to life as normal. Now, of course, there were undoubtedly going to be people who were going to be cautious about it. But we have lots of evidence, newspaper reports from pretty much every city that we studied, that people rushed to go back to movie theaters, for example, or to go bowling, or to go out to saloons, or to go shopping and congregate in downtown stores. Now, you have to remember that most of these orders were lifted in the sometime usually in November, depending on the particular epidemic in each city. And November 11th was Armistice Day. That was the announcement of the ceasefire and the end of World War I. And so lots of people got together. I mentioned Denver. Denver had a massive crowd form downtown because they lifted their closure order right on Armistice Day, as a number of cities did. In other communities, they lifted the orders a little bit later, but that was still in time for Thanksgiving, for example, and for the Christmas holidays. And so even though public health officials warned people that influenza was still around, it was still lurking, it was still highly contagious, people undoubtedly still met. And we have lots of evidence that people met for the holidays, for example. And so I think that there's something in human nature that just wants to get back to life as normal. And I think we don't even really need to look back to 1918 to draw lessons. We can just look at the last year with COVID-19 of how every time there has been an easing, whether it's in Michigan or in other states, an easing of any of these restrictions, we see another surge of cases because people take that as an indication that things are better and they can get back to life as normal. And no matter how many times we tell people, you know, the policy is going to change, but the recommendations don't, they really are going to pay attention more to the policy than to just individual recommendations.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm talking to J. Alexander Navarro, the Assistant Director at the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Alex, you talk a lot about sort of this rushed return to normal. Even lately on the messaging, specifically on personal responsibility as opposed to policy, I feel like it's so mixed and muddled right now specifically. Do you have the same impression right now that elected officials, public health experts, there just seems to be so much different guidance coming that, frankly, I did lose sight of some of it. Does that make sense? I guess, do you see that as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I really do think, and I can say this as a historian, someone who studies this, but I'm in the fortunate position of not having to make these very difficult decisions based on all these competing interests, public health, mental health issues, school closures, the economy, et cetera. You know, officials are in a very difficult position, but I think it is very muddled when you have some states that are going ahead and opening full throttle. Here in Michigan, we've had a more of a stepwise approach, but even then, I think we're probably opening up in-person dining and restaurants a little too quickly. And it is, I think people do get the sense generally that things are getting better. You know, we had this massive surge of cases in the winter. The weather's better now. People want to go outside. They want to meet with family and friends again. And I think the messaging that we're getting, regardless of what the actual words say, that when you reopen, people think that things are better. The problem now is that even though they might be better than they were in the winter, we have these new variants of concern that are circulating. Europe throughout this pandemic has really been sort of the bellwether of what is going to happen to the United States. We've lagged their trends by a couple of weeks to a month. And, you know, right now, Europe is going through a really bad surge of cases and hospitalizations. And that's starting to pick up again in the United States. So I'm really concerned that people are not taking this as seriously as they should. They see that vaccines are rolling out, and they are, and that's fantastic, but we're not quite there yet. We're not at herd immunity yet with this vaccination campaign. And so I think we do have to wait until we're fully, you know, at the end of that tunnel. Right now we see the light, but we need to wait till we break through into the sunshine before we really start relaxing our guard.
And the influenza pandemic of 1918, it didn't stop, I think, when everyone sort of hoped and expected it would. It continued stretching on into 1920. So tell me about people's response or lack thereof to increases in case numbers with these safety measures we were talking about. What was the people's reaction to the influenza pandemic when it kept stretching on longer than people had expected?
Yeah, so the first thing what happened is when communities lifted their initial closure orders, in about half the cities we studied, so more than half of the country really, any place outside of the Northeast, the pandemic wasn't really done yet, or at least even the worst of it wasn't done yet. And it proved very difficult for communities and states to re-implement closure orders. In many places, they were able to implement a second or sometimes even a third round of school closures. That's a little bit easier when you're talking about the safety of children, and people could understand that. But to get the same level of compliance for, you know, business closures, for example, that just wasn't going to fly a second time. And so really, we didn't find any community. There were a couple of small exceptions, but for the most part, no community really went back to the same level of closure orders they had previously. By the end of the fall, when public health officers are now saying that the pandemic is essentially over, even though it wasn't, there was no impetus to go back to any sort of closure orders. And so the message was sometimes quite literally, we will still continue to have cases and deaths. Just be cautious and go about your business. And that's exactly what people did. And as you mentioned, the pandemic stretched on throughout the winter of 1919. It then went away for the most part during the warmer months, and then came back with a vengeance in 1920. And if the pandemic of the 1918-1919 period hadn't happened, we'd be talking about the pandemic of 1920. It was that bad. It wasn't as bad as the previous waves, but it was still a significant public health crisis. But there was no drive to return to any sort of closure orders. And so people just sort of became inured to the death toll, you know. And we're talking at the time, the sort of semi-official number of deaths in the United States was around 550,000. And we're about that point now with COVID. Historians, we've sort of slowly bumped up the number of deaths in the 1918-1919 pandemic as we get better sort of estimates of how many people died who weren't counted, but it could have been as many as 675,000 Americans.
I wanted to talk about sort of the financial intervention on the part of the federal and the state government. So in our current pandemic, the federal government, the state government has tried to get money to people that haven't been able to work during the pandemic through unemployment or obviously the stimulus checks. Now, I mean, millions of people have had a bureaucratic nightmare accessing all that, but I wanted to ask, 100 years ago, like, was there financial support in place for people while businesses were shuttered and while they couldn't work? How does that compare?
For the most part, there was none. You know, certainly not from the government, whether it's federal, state, or local governments. That just wasn't the system, and people didn't expect that. You know, the way we think of things now is really a post-New Deal sort of form of thinking about how the federal government should respond to whatever the national crisis is, or, you know, in terms of public health laws, any kind of crisis. That was not the case in 1918-1919. People didn't expect that. What did happen is that there were lots of charitable organizations that were either already in existence that then maybe changed their course to deal with the post-pandemic aftermath. Local governments and state governments did often allocate funds to do things like erect temporary hospitals, to help care for orphans and widows. You know, there was some money allocated for that. But that safety net that we have today that we've come to expect from the federal government certainly did not exist in 1918-1919. And so part of the pandemic aftermath was caring for the numbers of people who had lost breadwinners, orphan children who had lost their parents who needed care, people who were still recuperating. And so maybe there was a household that was still sick and they weren't able to work and they were starving and they needed neighbors and other charitable organizations to come in and help them. And so that's really what the aftermath of the 1918 pandemic looked like, at least in the months following it.
J. Alexander Navarro is the assistant director at the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Alex, thanks so much for joining Stateside.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Max Johnston, in for April Bear. Thank you so much for listening.